Now, the family of Tony Robinson will receive a $3.35 million settlement. That's a settlement for a federal civil rights lawsuit over his death. Robinson, a 19-year-old biracial man, was unarmed when he was shot and killed almost 2 years ago by Madison police officer Matt Kenny. The lawsuit was against Kenny and the city of Madison.
Robinson was shot after police received 911 calls about him being aggressive and behaving erratically when he was under the influence of hallucinogens. His death sparked protests throughout the city and became a national headline during a period of high tensions between police and communities of color.
The settlement came yesterday in spite of the police department's objections. Robinson's grandmother called it, quote, bittersweet. But officers said that the case should have gone to trial so Officer Kenny would have a chance to defend himself. Kenny was previously cleared by the Dane County District Attorney of criminal wrongdoing.
Michael Bell joins us now. He's the father of a police shooting victim and is now an activist on police community issues. He's also a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. Michael, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, what was your first reaction when you heard news of this settlement yesterday?
My first reaction was, wow, that's an extremely high amount. Typically, we've never seen that type of amount issued in the settlement in the state of Wisconsin.
And the family and the family's attorney, the Robinson family, has said this is a clear indication that the law would have been on their side had they gone to trial. Do you agree with that assessment?
I went through this with my own son. He was killed in 2004. In 2010, the city of Kenosha settled with our family. It was based on the merits of the case. Realistically, and they are taking a look at risk management if this does go to jury and it does settle on behalf of the Robinson family, an extremely larger amount could be given to that family. I just recently shared with someone the results of Douglas Zerbe, who was killed in California. His family went to trial, and they received a $6.5 million settlement. So that's a big deal, and I think the insurance companies were minimizing their risk.
What does the decision to settle out of court instead of pushing to have it go to trial, what does that say to the public about this case?
Knowing what I know now, I don't think it's a decision whether the law officers or the public are matter. I think this is about minimizing the exposure to an overall risk. And I hear the same things that now as I heard in my own son's case. I mean, the police chief back in 2004 said, we want this thing to go to trial. We want to prove to the public, you know, that our officer was correct. And that's the exact same thing I'm hearing from both sides here. But I think the most important part here is this, is that There is a way out, and we have to quit looking at what the fault was, and have to look at really what was the cause, and determining why there was a number of factors that led to this young man's death, and is there something that we could do to prevent that? And that's what we're trying to work at here in Wisconsin.
And, you know, there were several different passes through this case from different angles. Madison DA, Dane County, Ishmael Ozan cleared Officer Kenny. No charges were filed. The Madison Police Department cleared Officer Kenny of any wrongdoing. There were those in Officer Kenny's favor. So what does that say about the process and how this has worked out so far?
And knowing what I know after 14 years of looking at this, the officer, you know, you have to give the officer the ability to defend himself if they need to. So therefore, he had no criminal wrongdoing. The law provided him to use deadly force if he needed to. And that's what they're adamant about on that side. What I'm arguing about as a father who lost a child is that were there other things that could have been done to prevent this chain of negative events that caused this boy to lose his life? Could Officer Kenny be treated for PTSD from an original shooting that happened maybe years before that? Could he have waited 30 seconds for backup to come in? Those types of things, and those have to be learned by a different system that isn't in place with law enforcement now.
And Michael, you're associated strongly here in Wisconsin with a law now in place to call for outside investigations when there's a police-involved shooting like this. The things you're talking about now here on the radio with us, looking for ways to avoid the situation altogether, maybe to offer PTSD treatment. That seems like it's outside of that law. How do we get at some of those things?
We're calling for an external learning model like they use in transportation. The NTSB, they take a look at when an airplane crashes, they take a look at what were all the factors that caused that death, and they issued recommendations on how to prevent it from happening again. And the FAA and the airlines either can accept or reject those recommendations. We are calling for an external learning model in law enforcement where these could be looked at and determine if there were human factors or communication issues that might have led to that death, and then issue recommendations on how to prevent it from happening again, and also compiling a database so that we can understand that if we do implement some type of reform, is it taking hold? And most importantly, once these lessons are learned, let's have a dissemination mechanism so that way these lessons can be shared with all 700 law enforcement agencies in the state of Wisconsin so that way they can all be speaking on the same page. That's what happens in aviation. That's what makes it successful. That's what needs to happen in law enforcement.
In a case like this, which is highly emotionally charged and parties concerned are assigning things like innocence or guilt and also punitive damages, monetary amounts to be paid out, how do you get people to get interested in the things that you're talking about, looking at an overall big picture sort of model?
I want to tell your listeners that Jim Palmer over at the Wisconsin Professional Police Association and I got over those emotions back in 2010. We came together as two fathers that wanted to make things better for both law enforcement and the community. So we were able to do it, and I assure you that other people can do it. If we have to take the attention off of finding fault, which is what's occurring now because the police are blaming Robinson and Robinson's family are blaming the police. But we have to look at what was the true cause that led to it and how do we prevent it from happening again. And that's the secret.
We're talking right now with Michael Bell. He's the activist father of police shooting victim Michael Bell Jr. And we're looking at the case of Tony Robinson, who was shot and killed by a police officer in Madison in 2015. His family received a $3.35 million settlement from the city insurer yesterday.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation right now with Michael Bell. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force and the father of a police shooting victim. Yesterday, the family of Tony Robinson received millions to settle a federal civil rights lawsuit over his death in a police shooting in 2015. And Michael, when we left off, you were looking for more of a find and fix model with police shootings, similar to what happens after a plane crash, where there's a lot of culling of evidence and trying to figure out what went wrong and then disseminating that information. Can you give us more details on what that might look like when it comes to law enforcement in a case like this?
Well, a partied review is what the National Transportation Safety Board actually uses. They gather all the evidence and then they actually argue about the evidence to determine what they feel was the true cause. And then after they determine the true cause, then they issue a number of safety recommendations. I recently wrote an article, in fact, it was published in the Capital Times, I think it was last month, and what I did is I took two examples. I took a shooting out of Beaverton, Ohio, at a Walmart where a guy was walking to the back of the store and he picked up a plastic gun, and people saw him in the store and called 911 and said, there's a man in the store with a gun, and he was actually shot by a police officer. And then I used an example of a man that was flying an airplane out of St. Louis. He taxied onto a runway, and an airplane, a jetliner that was taking off actually hit his aircraft and killed him and his passenger. But both of those were reviewed, but the outcomes were significantly different. In the St. Louis aviation crash, a number of recommendations were issued, and we improved aviation because of it. But in the Beaverton, Ohio Walmart shooting, nothing changed. It remained the same, and we know that it's going to happen again at a later date. And so that's what we're looking for here. Determine what really went wrong, issue recommendations, disseminate those lessons to law enforcement, and then see if we can start bringing down those fatal shootings. They estimate that 25% of fatal shootings are what's called mistake of fact, and that's what happened with my own son. My son did not have his hand on a gun or anything like that. An officer mistaken that, and therefore my son died. And the Douglas Zerbe shooting that I talked about earlier, he was holding a spray nozzle for a garden hose, and he mistook it as a gun. We take a look at Tamir Rice. Those type of shootings are a mistake of fact, and they can be improved upon.
When you talk about disseminating the findings, you find out what went wrong, and you try to get a fix for it, and then you want to get that information out to other, you know, say, law enforcement agencies in the state or in the country. Do you think there's openness to that? It seems as though there are different cultures within law enforcement and maybe different degrees of willingness to be told maybe a so-called right way or a new finding about how to do something. How do you think that part of it would work?
I think it's actually playing out quite well, because I just recently had a conversation with one of the past president of the Wisconsin Police Chiefs Association, and he informed me that after our law passed, a week later, we had the Dontre Hamilton shooting in Milwaukee. Well, because of our law, now a public report is being issued, and good police chiefs are actually taking a look at those reports and trying to find out what really happened in that shooting and how can they train their officers better to make sure that that doesn't happen again. That right there is the basic dissemination of that knowledge, and that's the path that we're moving on in law enforcement.
And Michael, as we wrap up, as you've been talking about, you're the father. Your son was also shot and killed by police. And again, I'm so sorry for that loss. Having gone through that experience, what do you recommend for family and for community members who are trying to move forward and to heal after something like this happens?
Two things. First off is you have to understand that I support law enforcement. Very difficult job. But sometimes the training could cause problems, and sometimes there is bad policing, but we need to stand up for that. And to the family that lost a child, it's devastating. And even our family, we used our settlement to go ahead and help change the law. Possibly that might happen with the Robinson family, that they could use some of those funds to help make things better for everybody. So that's what I can recommend.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Bell is the father of a police shooting victim. Now he's an activist on police community issues. Also a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. He joined us to talk about how Wisconsin might deal with officer-involved shootings in the future.
And you can support important conversations like this one with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Okay, Rob, riddle me this. A special Food Friday riddle
okay.
for you. Okay. What's round, has a hole in the middle, and is found in 2 out of every 3 American kitchens?
Going with donuts? Or maybe that's just wishful thinking?
Yeah, it's wishful
thinking. They're not in all the kitchens.
They are tasty, but I digress. The answer is a Bundt cake pan.
Okay.
And it turns out the tried and true Bundt pan has a really long and interesting history.
Terry Milligan joins us now with some creative ways to bake with the Bundt pan, not just sweet stuff, by the way. She's a chef and culinary speaker and instructor. She teaches classes around the state. Her food articles appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Edible Door magazine. Her recent article looks at the birth of the Bundt pan and highlights a few of her favorite recipes. Terry, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me again.
Well, yeah, I've got that. I got to say the Bundt pan, one of the least utilized pieces of equipment in my personal kitchen. But tell us a bit about the origins of the Bundt pan. Where did this come from?
Well, it actually is over, well, now 71 years old. It had its 70th anniversary last year, and it originated not too far from us in Minnesota by the Nordic Ware Company, which is still who makes it. They actually trademarked the name, so a Bundt pan is their pan, just like a crock pot is a slow cooker. They've got the Bundt pan, and they've trademarked it, but it's been around for 71 years.
And it sounds like part of the special innovation of the Bundt pan is the hole in the middle. What does it do?
Well, the hole in the middle actually makes the cake bake a little more evenly. So you don't, sometimes if you, I think you may bake, but when you have that cake and you have that middle part, it can be a little soft. It's hard to get the middle done and the sides are a little overcooked. With a Bundt cake, you don't have that problem because you've got the hole in the middle. So it has a nice, even bake. It also kind of becomes its own frosting when you push it out. It has that pretty decorative look to it. So even a novice baker can make a beautiful cake with a Bundt pan.
And what's up with sort of the scalloped, bottom and sides of that? Is that just aesthetic, or does that help with the cooking process somehow?
Well, I think it's more aesthetic. It doesn't help that much. It just makes it so that it looks pretty even without frosting on it. And it also originated from a German cake pan that was very heavy. It was a 15-pound pan, and the folks that developed it, that was heavy. It was made with cast iron.
Wow.
Cooking, yeah.
Exactly. When they developed it over at the Nordic Ware, they had some folks that lived in the area that came over and said, could you make a pan that's a little more easy to use in the kitchen than the 15-pound cake pan? And that's how they developed this Bundt pan. And it actually wasn't a big seller right at first, and it didn't become a big seller till 1966, when someone came in second, not first, but second in the Pillsbury Bake Off with something called the Tunnel of Fudge. And it was a cake that was made in the pan, and it made its own little fudge kind of tunnel in the middle of it as it baked. But they didn't even win. But it became the most popular cake pan then from now on after that.
Yeah, I looked up that Tunnel of Fudge cake after reading your article, and it does look pretty delicious, I have to say.
It does.
Is it hard to make? Have you made it, Terry?
I have made it, and it's not hard to make. It kind of makes itself its own little fudge cake in there. In my article, I did a little kind of an offshoot of it. I did a red velvet Bundt cake that had cream cheese in the middle. So kind of another version of that kind of a cake that has a little middle cream, kind of delight in the center of it.
I want to get into, we've got a recipe we'll get to that we have on the Facebook page in a minute, but one that really struck me in your article, you can do savory cooking. Guys think Bundt pan, I think Bundt cake, something sweet.
Mm-hmm.
You've got basically a spaghetti Bundt something.
Casserole.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't know what to call it.
It looked good, though. The picture
looked
great.
It did look really good.
What are you calling this? So I think we call it a spaghetti Bundt cake or something. But basically you can use spaghetti, you can use whatever cooked pasta you like, and it's a way to form the pasta in a ring with some cheese, and I think I have a little eggs in there too. I put some sun-dried tomatoes and some spinach inside of it as well, and then it bakes and you just unmold it, and you can slice it and serve it with marinara sauce. So it's very easy, and it's fun to put on a buffet, and it looks pretty.
Well, Terry, I have to ask you, excuse me if this is a personal question, but how many Bundt pans do you own?
I actually only own one.
Only own one?
Yes,
really?
I do. I know, but it's only the two of us.
Ah.
But it is my mother's Bundt pan, so I guess, Bundt pans seem to go passed down in his, in the family a lot of times. So I only own one, but I do happen to have connections. So when I did this article, I had three or four in the kitchen.
I see. Well, I've seen different molds now. I mean, there's the classic one you're talking about, and I bought one a while ago. I can't remember the maker, but it looked sort of more like architecture. The inside of it looked like it was a castle when it was unmolded.
They've made so many different versions. I think there's actually over 70 now. I've seen some that look like flowers, some like yours that you're talking are more kind of almost diamond-shaped and pointed. So they've just come up with tons of different ones. During their anniversary year, Nordic Ware actually put out again the original Bundt pan in an anniversary edition that was really kind of fancy looking. So they have come out with many, many, and also little individual Bundt pans. They call them something I can't recall, but little baby Bundt pans that you can make kind of individual ones.
You get all the different shapes, then play with them like Legos and make crazy Lego, Bundt structures of food and cake.
You can.
Right,
and
something to aspire to.
I kind of like that, too, to see when they come out and they're all, it's just so interesting looking.
So let's get to the recipe we have up on the Central Time Facebook page, one you shared with us. We've talked a little sweet. We've talked a little savory. So this one kind of splits the difference. The olive oil rosemary cornmeal cake. Talk us through this recipe.
Well, what's neat about this cake, it is a little bit sweet, a little bit savory. You could use it for breakfast, or you could use it for a dessert. And instead of butter in it, it has olive oil. And the olive oil gives it a very interesting flavor and keeps it very moist. And then I also put fresh rosemary in it. And the cornmeal I use, I don't like to use a real, for the listeners, you use just a regular cornmeal that's not a stone ground cornmeal. It gets a little too course for the cake. So use a finer cornmeal for it. And then I just dust it with powdered sugar on the on your site. I think it probably shows the same photo I have, which has it with just some strawberries and a little whipped cream. But you can certainly have that with a cup of coffee in the morning, or you can have it at night with, you might want to put a little Grand Marnier or something like that in your whipped cream and have it for a fancy dessert.
What does the olive oil do in that recipe?
Well, it serves as the oil base in it. So in a regular cake, you usually would have butter or vegetable oil. In this case, you're using olive oil. So it gives it an interesting flavor as well, because try to use like a fruitier kind of olive oil, but always extra virgin when you're going to work with this, because you want a really pleasant flavored olive oil. So it keeps it moist and gives it some different flavors.
We heard from Kenneth in Janesville, who wants to know, what does bunt mean? And it's B-U-N-D-T. I assume it has nothing to do with baseball type of bunting. Do you know where that name itself came from?
Well, I heard that it is a derivative of a German word. And the original folks that came and asked the folks to make the bunt can, it was a Buntkuchen, something like that, the original cake. But I think it translates to gathering. And the cake itself is kind of a larger cake, a pretty cake that would be used for a gathering.
And tell us a little bit about that red velvet cream cheesy one you described. My kids love red velvet anything. How does that one come together?
It's, again, very easy. You make a base of a cake base with cocoa powder in it in this instance, and then you make a cream cheese filling. So you put half of the cake batter in your bundt pan, then the little cream cheese filling, and then more of the cake batter, and it just bakes unmolded. And on my website, there's a pretty picture of it with the little cake cream cheese in the center and then a little cream cheese glaze on top. It is extremely good and very, very moist.
Well, I want to ask you about something. One of my, black beasts when I'm cooking this kind of cake, I'm always a little bit afraid because I'm afraid it's not going to unmold. And so I put like a pound of butter in there and then a pound of flour. This is just to like make sure it doesn't stick. And sometimes it still sticks. What's the secret there?
Well, I have to say, I usually give all of the little bundt pans a little spray of nonstick food spray. And like a Pam, but something like that, and they always come out then.
Oh, so you don't do the old-fashioned butter and flour. You just use a spray.
Well, I kind of do a little of both. I give it a little bit of spray. That's my insurance policy. So I always give it a little spray, and then I do the butter. And, in fact, the cake that you're referring to with the red velvet, instead of flour, I dusted it with cocoa powder.
Uh-huh.
All right, now
yeah,
I'm
so you got a little bit more cocoa in there.
Oh, okay. Now I'm thinking of different ways to try this. Tell me why this wouldn't work. I use a bundt pan for a frittata with the eggs in there. You know, it's like a crustless quiche. What would that work?
Kind of deep. I don't know. What do you think?
It might be too thick.
Right. You'd have to make sure the eggs got cooked enough in the center. You know, that's because you don't want to overcook. But I bet it might. You might not want to go quite as high as
right.
the very, very top.
I was going to say that'd be about 40 eggs.
Yeah. And I guess your next question would be, why would I want to do that?
Why
and I'm not sure.
This?
I'm not sure. But I think it'd be cool.
Yeah. Are there other frontiers here that we haven't thought of? We've got the pasta bake. We've got the desserts. Are there other things you can do in a bundt pan, Terry?
Well, I also make something for birds. I make a birdseed wreath in the bundt pan. My father actually owned a birdseed company in Indiana, and so I have an affinity for liking the little feathered birds out there. Then I live in Door County, and I like to feed them. So I make a birdseed cake, I guess you'd call it, for them. And the glue is really easy. It's just water and cornstarch and Knox gelatin. Then you put your bird seed in there. I usually give them a few dried cranberries or dried cherries along with it, and you just put it in there and let it dry for a couple of days and unmold it, and then I put it right outside. I will say the squirrels also like it as well.
That's so cool. I'm going to try that. Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Terry Milligan, chef and culinary speaker and instructor who teaches classes throughout Wisconsin. Her food articles appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Edible Door magazine. And today we have been basking in the glory of the bundt pan.
And you can find that recipe we were talking about earlier, the olive oil rosemary cornmeal cake, over at the Central Time Facebook page.